I'd never noticed before. A room whose open doorway stood off the corridor I had to follow. I'd pass the entrance and the skin on my back would crawl. Invisible worms would tingle their way across the backs of my arms. I'd see her, sketched by shadows, her pale hands like spiders writhing from black sleeves. In that moment, when I tried to run, I'd become mired, as if I ran through molasses. I'd struggle, trying to shout, vomiting silence, a fly in the web. And she would advance, slow, inevitable, her face inching into the light. I'd see her eyes and wake screaming.
"So you're not worried he'll come after you again?" I asked.
Thunder came in a sudden clap, shaking the barn.
"He has to be close," the Nuban said. "He has to know where you are."
I let go of a breath I hadn't realized I'd been keeping.
"He'll send his hunter after us instead,"
the Nuban said. I heard the rustle as he pulled the hay down on himself. "That's a pity," I said. It had been a long time since I'd dreamed of my own dream witch. I rather liked the idea that she might be chasing us here, to this barn, in the jaws of the storm. I settled back into the prickle of the hay. "I'll see if I can dream a witch tonight, yours or mine, I don't care. And if I do, this time I'm not running anywhere. I'm going to turn around and gut the bitch." Chapter 16. 4 years earlier. Thunder again. It held me for a moment. I felt it in my chest. Then the lightning, spelling out the world in harsh new shapes. I saw visions in the after images. A baby shaken until the blood came from its eyes. Children dancing in a fire. Another rumble rattled the boards, and the darkness returned. I sat in the confusion between sleep and the waking world, surrounded by the creak of wood, the shake and rattle of the wind. Lightning stabbed again, and I saw the interior of the carriage. Mother opposite, William beside her, curled upon the bench seat, his knees to his chest. "The storm!" I twisted and caught the window. The slats resisted me, spitting rain as the wind whistled outside.
"Shush, Jorg," Mother said. "Go back to sleep."
I couldn't see her in the dark, but the carriage held her scent, roses and lemongrass. "The storm!" I knew I'd forgotten something. That much I remembered.
"Just rain and wind. Don't let it frighten you, Jorg, love."
Did it frighten me? I listened as the gusts ran their claws around the door.
"We have to stay in the carriage," she said.
I let the roll and rock of the carriage take me, hunting for that memory, trying to jog it loose.
"Sleep, Jorg."
It was more of a command than a recommendation.
"How does she know I'm not asleep?"
Lightning struck so close I could hear the sizzle. The lights crossed her face in three bars, making something feral of her eyes.
"We have to stop the carriage. We have to get off. We have to..." "Go to sleep."
Her voice carried an edge. I tried to stand and found myself weighed down, as if I were wading in the thickest mud or molasses.
"You're not my mother."
"Stay in the carriage," she said, her voice a whisper. The tang of cloves cut the darkness, a breath of myrrh beneath it, the perfume of the grave. The stink of it smothered all sound, except the slow rasp of her breath. I hunted the door handle with blind fingers. Instead of cold metal, I found corruption. The softness of flesh turned sour in death. A scream broke from me, but it couldn't pierce the silence. I saw her in the next flash of the storm, skin peeled from the bone, raw pits for eyes. Fear took my strength. I felt it running down my leg in a hot flood.
"Come to Mother."
Fingers like twigs closed around my arm and drew me forward in the blackness. No thoughts would form in the terror that held me. Words trembled on my lips, but I had no mind to know what they would be.
"You're not her," I said.
One more flash, revealing her face an inch before mine,
One more flash, and in it I saw my mother dying, bleeding in the rain of a wild night, and me hung on the briar, helpless in a grip made of more than thorns, held by fear. A cold rage rose in me. From the gut, I drove my forehead into the ruin of the monster's face, and took the door handle with a surety that needed no sight. No! And I leapt into the storm. The thunder rolled loud enough to wake even the deepest buried. I jerked into a sitting position, confused by the stink of hay and the prickle of straw all around me. The barn! I remembered the barn. A single point of illumination broke the night. A lantern's glow. It hung from a beam close by the barn door. A figure, a man, a tall one, stood in the fringes of the light. The Nuban lay at his feet, caught in a troubled sleep. I made to cry out, then bit my cheek hard enough to stop myself. The copper tang of the blood sharpened away the remnants of my dream. The man held the biggest crossbow I'd ever seen. With one hand, he began to wind back the cable. He took his time. When you're hunting on behalf of a dream witch, I guess you're never in a rush. Unless one of your victims escapes, whatever dreams have been sent to keep them sleeping. I reached for my knife and found nothing. I guessed it lost along whatever path my nightmare had led me through the hay. The lantern struck a gleam from something metal by my feet. A baling hook. 3 more turns on that crank, and he'd be done. I took the hook. The storm howl covered my approach. I didn't sneak. I walked across slow enough to be sure of my footing, fast enough to give ill fortune no time to act against me. I thought to reach around and cut the bastard's throat, but he was tall, too tall for a 10-year-old's reach. He lifted the crossbow to sight down at the Nuban. Wait when waiting is called for. That's when Lundist used to tell me. But never hesitate. I hooked the hunter between the legs and yanked up as hard as I could. Where the crash of thunder and the roar of the wind had failed, the hunter's scream succeeded. The Nuban woke up, and to his credit, there was no wondering where he was or what was happening. He surged to his feet and had a foot of steel through the man's chest in 2 heartbeats. We stood with the hunter lying between us, each with our weapon bloodied. The Nuban wiped his blade on the hunter's cloak. That's a big old crossbow. I towed it across the floor and marveled at the weight of it. The Nuban lifted the bow. He ran his fingers over the metalwork inlaid on the wood. My people made this. He traced the symbols and the faces of fierce gods. And now I owe you another life. He hefted the crossbow and smiled, his teeth a white line in the lantern glow. One will be enough. I paused. It's Count Renner that has to die. And the smile left him. Chapter 17. The old corridors enfolded me, and 4 years became a dream. Familiar turns, the same vases, the same suits of armor, the same paintings, even the same guards. 4 years, and everything was the same. Except me. In the niches, small silver lamps burned oil squeezed from whales in distant seas. I walked from one pool of light to the next, behind a guard whose armor beggared my own. Makin and Gomst had been led to separate destinations, and I went alone to whatever reception awaited. The place still made me feel small. Doors built for giants, ceilings soaring so high that a man with a lance could scarcely touch them. We came to the west wing, the royal quarters. Would father meet me here? Man to man in the arboretum. Souls bared beneath the planetarium dome. I'd imagined him seated in the black claw of his throne, brooding above the court, and me led toward him between the men of the Imperial Guard. I followed the single guard, feeling vaguely cheated. Did I want to be surrounded by armed men? Had I grown so dangerous, to be heaped with chains? Did I want him to fear me? 14 years old, and the King of Ankrath quaking behind his bodyguard. I felt foolish for a moment. I brushed a hand over the hilt of my sword. They'd cast the blade from the metal that ran through the castle walls. A true heirloom, with a heritage at the tall castle predating mine by 1,000 years at least. I ached for a confrontation then. Voices rose at the back of my mind, clamoring, fighting one against the other. The skin on my back tingled. The muscle beneath twitched for action.
"A bath, Prince Jorg."
It was the guardsman. I nearly drew on him.
"No,"
I said. I forced myself to calmness. "I'll see the king now."
"King Olidan has retired, Prince,"
the guard said. Was he smirking at me? His eyes held an intelligence I didn't associate with the palace guard.
"Asleep? I would have given a year of my life to take the surprise from those words." I felt like Captain Codin must have, the butt of a joke I had yet to comprehend.
"Sagis awaits you in the library, my prince," the man said. He turned to go, but I had him by the throat. Asleep? They were playing with me. Father and this pet magician of his. "This game," I said. "I expect it will provide amusement to somebody, but if you worry me one more time, I will kill you. Think on it. You're a piece in somebody else's game, and all you'll earn from it is a sword through the stomach, unless you redeem yourself in the next 20 seconds.
It was a defeat, resorting to crude threats in a game of subtlety. But sometimes one must sacrifice a battle to win the war.
"Prince, Sagis is waiting for you." I could see I'd turned his smug superiority into terror. I'd stepped outside the rules of play. I squeezed his throat a little.
"Why would I want to speak to this Sagis? What's he to me?"
He holds the king's favor. Please, Prince Jorg."
He got the words out past my fingers. It takes no great strength to throttle a man if you know where to grip. I let him go, and he fell, gasping.
"In the library, you say? What's your name, man?"
"Yes, my prince, in the library."
He rubbed at his neck.
"Robart."
"My name is Robart Hool." I strode out across the Hall of Spears, angling for the leather door to the library. I paused before it, turning back to Robart.
"There are turning points, Robart. Forks in the path we follow through our lives. Times that we look back to and say, if only. This is one of those times. It's not often we get them pointed out to us. At this point, you'll either decide to hate me or to serve me. Consider the choice carefully." I threw the library door open. It slammed back into the wall, and I walked through. In my mind, the library wall stretched to the very heavens, thick with books, pregnant with the written word. I learned to read at 3 years of age. I was talking with Socrates at 7, learning form and thing from Aristotle. For the longest time, I had lived in this library. Memory dwarfed reality. The place looked small now, small and dusty.
"I've burned more books than this," I said.
Sagis stepped out from the aisle, given over to ancient philosophy. He was younger than I expected, 40 at the most, wearing just a white cloth, like the Roman togara. His skin held the dusky hue of the Middle Lands, maybe Indus or Persia, but I could see it only in the rare spots the tattooist's needle hadn't found. He wore the text of a small book on his living hide, cut there in the flowing script of the mathematicians. His eyes, well, I know we're supposed to cower beneath the gaze of potent men, but his eyes were mild. They reminded me of the cows on the castle road, brown and placid. His scrutiny was the thing that cut. Somehow those mild eyes dug in. Perhaps the script beneath them bore the power. All I can say is that for a time uncounted, I could see nothing but the heathen's eyes, hear nothing but his breath, stir no muscle but my heart. He let me go like a fish thrown back into the river, too small for the pot. We stood face to face, inches apart, and I'd no memory of closing the gap. But I'd come to him. We stood among the books, among the wise words of 10,000 years. Plato to my left, copied, copied, and copied again. The moderns to my right, Russell, Popper, Zhang, and the rest. A small voice inside me, deep inside, called for blood.
but the heathen had taken the fire from me. Father must depend upon you, Sagius, I said. I twisted my fingers, wanting to want my sword. To have a pagan at court must vex the priests. If the Pope dared leave Roma these days, she'd be here to curse your soul to eternal hellfire.
I'd had nothing but dogma with which to beat him. Sagius smiled a friendly smile, like I'd just run an errand for him.
Prince Jorg, welcome home.
He had no real accent, but he ran his words out fluid and musical, like a Saracen or a Moor. He stood no taller than me. In fact, I probably had an inch on him. He was lean, too, so I could have taken him to the floor there and then, and choked the life out of him. One murderous thought bubbled up after another, and leaked away.
There's a lot of your father in you, he said.
Have you got him tamed, too? I asked.
One doesn't tame a man like Orlidan Ankrath.
His friendly smile took an edge of amusement. I wanted to know the joke. He could manage me, but not my father. Or he could manipulate the king and choose to cover the fact with a smirk. I imagined the heathen's tattooed head shorn from his shoulders, his smile frozen and blood pumping from the stump of his neck. In that instant, I reached for my sword and threw all my will behind the action. The pommel felt cold beneath my touch. I curled my fingers around the hilt, but before I could squeeze them tight, my hand fell away like a dead thing. Sagius raised a brow at that. He'd had them shaved like his head, and drawn back in. He took a step backward.
You're an interesting young man, Prince Jorg.
His eyes hardened, mild one moment, and in the next, dead as flint.
We shall have to find out what makes you tick, yes? I'll have Robard escort you to your chamber. You must be tired.
All the time he spoke, the fingers of his right hand traced words in the flowing script across his left arm. Brushing over one symbol, jumping higher to a black crescent moon, underlining a phrase, underlining it again. I did feel tired. I felt lead in every limb, pulling me down.
Robard!
He called out loud enough for the corridor. He looked back to me, mild again.
I expect you'll have dreams, Prince, after so long away.
His fingers moved over new lines, left hand, right arm. He traced words blacker than night across the veins in his wrists.
Dreams tell a man who he is.
I struggled to keep my eyes open. On Sagius's neck, just to the left of his Adam's apple, amid all the tight-packed scrawl, was a letter bigger than the rest, curled and recurled so it looked like a flower. Touch the flower, I thought. Touch the pretty flower. And as if by magic, my treacherous hand moved. It took him by surprise. My fingers at his throat. I heard the door open behind me. He's skinny, I thought. So skinny. I wonder if I could close my hand around his neck. I admitted no hint of violence, just curiosity. And there it was, my hand around his neck. I heard Robart's sudden intake of breath. Sagius stood frozen, his mouth half open, as if he couldn't believe it. I could barely stand. I could hardly keep the yawning from my voice. But I held his eye and let him think that the pressure I put on him was a threat, and not to keep me from falling.
My dreams are my own, heathen, I said. Pray you're not in them.
I turned then, before I fell, and strode past Robart. He caught up in the Hall of Spears.
I've never seen anyone lay a hand on Sagius, my prince.
My prince, that was better. There was admiration in his voice. Maybe genuine, maybe not. I was too tired to care.
He's a dangerous man. His enemies die in their sleep. That or they're broken. Lord Jael left the court 2 days after disagreeing with the pagan in front of your father. They say he can't feed himself now, and spends his days singing an old nursery rhyme over and over.
I reached the west stair. Robart prattling beside me. He broke off all of a sudden.
Your chamber is off the red corridor, my prince.
He stopped and studied his boots.
The princess has your former chamber.
Princess? I didn't care. Tomorrow I would find out. I let him lead me to my room, one of the guest rooms off the red corridor. The chamber could have housed many a tavern I'd slept in. But it was a studied insult nonetheless.
a room for a country baron or distant cousin visiting from the protectorates. I stopped at the door, reeling with exhaustion. Sagus's spell bit deeper, and my strength left me like blood from sliced veins. "I told you it was time to choose, Robart," I said. I forced the words out one by one. "Get Makin Bortha here. Let him guard my door this night. Time to choose." I didn't wait for a reply. If I had, he'd have had to carry me to bed. I pushed the door and half staggered, half fell into the chamber. I collapsed back against the door, closing it, and slid to the floor. It felt like I kept on sliding, deeper and deeper, into an endless well. Chapter 18. I woke up with that sudden convulsion you get when every muscle you own suddenly realizes it's dropped off on duty. Next came the shock of realizing how deeply I'd been asleep. You don't sleep like that on the road, not if you want to wake up again. For a moment, the darkness would yield nothing to my confusion. I reached for my sword and found only soft sheets. The tall castle. It came back to me. I remembered the pagan and his spell. I rolled to the right. I always left my gear on my right side. Nothing but more mattress, soft and deep. I might have been blind for all the help my eyes gave. I guess the shutters were shut tight, for not the slightest whisper of starlight reached me. It was quiet, too. I reached out for the edge of the bed and didn't find it. A wide bed, I thought, trying to find some humor in the situation. I let go the breath I'd been holding, the one I sucked in so fast when I woke. What was it that made me start? What dragged me out of the pagan spell in this oh-so-comfortable bed? I pulled my hand back, drew my knees to my chest. Somebody had put me to bed and taken my clothes. Not Makin. He'd not leave me naked against the night. That somebody and I would be having a discussion soon enough. But it could wait until morning. I just wanted to sleep, to let the day come. Only sleep had kicked me out, and it wasn't about to let me back in. So I lay there, naked in the strange bed, and wondered where my sword was. The noise came so quiet at first, I could believe I imagined it. I stared blind into the darkness and let my ears suck in the silence. It came again, soft as the whisper of flesh on stone. I could hear the ghost of a sound, a breath being drawn. Or maybe just a night breeze fingering its way through the shutters. Ice ran up my spine, tingling on my shoulders. I sat up, biting back the urge to speak, to show bravado to the unseen terrors. "I'm not 6 years old," I told myself. "I've made the dead run." I threw the sheets back and stood up. If the pagan's horror was waiting in the darkness, then sheets would be no shield. With my hands held up before me, I walked forward, finding first the elusive edge of the bed and then the wall. I turned and followed it, fingers trailing the stonework. Something went tumbling and broke with an expensive crash. I barked my shins on an unseen obstacle, nearly groined myself on a sideboard of some kind, then found the shutter slats. I fumbled with the shutter catch. It defied me, maddeningly, as though my fingers were frost clumsy. The skin on my back crawled. I heard footsteps drawing closer. I hauled on the shutters with all my strength. Every move I made seemed slow and feeble, as though I moved through molasses, like in those dreams where the witch chases you and you can't run. The shutters gave without warning. They flew back, and I found that I was standing high above the execution yard, drenched in moonlight. I spun around, slow, too slow, and found nothing. Just a room of silver and shadows. The window threw the moonlight on the wall to my right. My shadow reached forward in the arch of the window and fell at the feet of a tall portrait, a full-length picture of a woman. I went numb. My face felt like a mask. I knew the picture. Mother. Mother in the great hall. Mother in a white dress, tall and icy in her perfection. She said she never liked that picture, that the artist had made her too distant, too much the queen. Only William softened it, she said. If she'd not had William hugging to her skirts, she would have given the picture away, she said. But she couldn't throw little William away. I pulled my eyes from her face, pale in the silver light. She loomed above me, tall in life, taller in the portrait. Her dress fell in cascades of lace froth. The artist had caught it well. He made it look real. The open shutters let in a chill, and I felt a cold beyond any autumn frost. My skin rose in tiny bumps. She couldn't throw William away. Only William wasn't there anymore. I took a step back toward the open window. Sweet Jesus! I blinked away tears. Mother's eyes followed me. Jesus wasn't there, Jorg, she said. Nobody came to save us. You watched us, Jorg. You watched. But you didn't come to help. No! I felt the windowsill cold against the back of my knees. The thorns held me. She looked at me, eyes silver with the moon. She smiled, and I thought for a moment she would forgive me. Then she screamed. She didn't scream the scream she'd made when the Count's men raped her. I could have stood that. Maybe. She screamed the scream she made when they killed William. Ugly, hoarse, animal screams, torn from her perfect painted face. I howled back. The words burst from me. The thorns! I tried, Mother! I tried! He rose up from behind the bed then. William. Sweet William, with the side of his head caved in. The blood clotted black on his golden hair. The eye that side was gone. But the other held me. You let me die, Jorg, he said. He spoke it past a bubbling in his throat. Well. I couldn't say any more. He lifted a hand to me, white with the trickles of blood darkest crimson. The window yawned behind me, and I made to throw myself back through it. But as I did, something jolted me forward. I staggered and righted myself. Will stood there, silent now. Jorg! Jorg! A shout reached me, distant, but somehow familiar. I looked back toward the window and the dizzying fall. Jump, said William. Jump, Mother said. But Mother didn't sound like Mother anymore. Jorg! Prince Jorg! The shout came louder now, and a more violent jolt threw me to the floor. Get out of the fucking way, boy! I recognized Makin's voice. He stood framed in the doorway, lamplight behind. And somehow I lay on the floor at his feet, not by the window, not naked, but in my armor still. You were jammed up against the door, Jorg, Makin said. This robot fellow told me to come running. And here you are, screaming behind the door. He glanced around, looking for the danger. I ran from the south wing for your blasted nightmare, did I? He shoved the door open wider and added a belated, Prince. I got to my feet, feeling as if I'd been rolled on by Fat Burlow. There was no painting on the wall, no Mother, no Will behind the bed. I drew my sword. I needed to kill Sagus. I wanted it so badly I could taste it, like blood, hot and salt in my mouth. Jorg? Makin asked. He looked worried, as if he was wondering if I'd gone mad. I moved toward the open door. Makin stepped to block me. You can't go out there with a drawn sword, Jorg. The guard would have to stop you. He didn't stand as tall or as wide as Reich. But Makin was a big man, broad in the shoulder, and stronger than a man should be. I didn't think I could take him down without killing him. "It's all about sacrifice, Makin," I said. I let my sword drop.
"Prince?"
He frowned. "I'm going to let that tattooed bastard live," I said. "I need him." I glimpsed my mother again fading. "I need to understand what game is being played out here, who exactly the pieces are, and who the players are." Makin's frown deepened. "You get some sleep, Jorg. In the bed this time." He glanced back into the corridor. "Do you want some light in there?" I smiled at that. "No," I said. "I'm not afraid of the dark." Chapter 19. I woke early. A grey light through the shutters showed me the room for the first time. Big, well furnished, hunting tapestries on the walls. I uncoiled my fingers from my sword hilt, stretched and yawned. It didn't feel right, this bed. It was too soft, too clean. When I threw the covers back, they knocked the servant bell from the bedside table. It hit the flagstones with a pretty tinkling, then bounced onto a rug and lost its voice. Nobody came. That suited me fine. I'd dressed myself for 4 years. Hell, I'd rarely undressed. And what rags I had would be put to shame by the meanest of servant smocks. Even so, nobody came. I wore my armor over the grey tatters of my shirt. A looking glass lay on the sideboard. I let it lie there face down. A quick run of fingers through hair in search of any louse fat enough to be found, and I was ready to break my fast. First, I threw the shutters open. No fumbling with the catch this time. I looked out over the execution yard, a square bounded by the blank walls of the tall castle. Kitchen boys and maids hastened across the bleak courtyard, going about their various quests, blind to the pale wash of the sky so high above them. I turned from the window and set off on my own little quest. Every prince knows the kitchens better than any other quarter of his castle. Where else can so much adventure be found? Where else is the truth spoken so plain? William and I learned 100 times more in the kitchens of the tall castle than from our books on Latin and strategy. We'd steal ink-handed from Lundy's study and sprint through long corridors, leaping down the stairs too many at a time, to reach the refuge of the kitchens. I walked those same corridors now, ill at ease in the confined space. I'd spent too long under wide skies, living bloody. We learned about death in the kitchens, too. We watched the cook turn live chickens to dead meat with a twist of his hands. We watched Ethel, the bread, pluck the fat hens, leaving them naked in death, ready for gutting. You soon learn there's no elegance or dignity in death if you spend time in the castle kitchens. You learn how ugly it is, and how good it tastes. I turned the corner at the end of the red corridor, too full of memories to pay attention. All I saw was a figure bearing down on me. Instincts learned on the road took over. Before I had time to register the long hair and silks, I had her against the wall, a hand across her mouth, and my knife to her throat. We were face by face, and my captive held my stare, eyes an unreal green like stained glass. I let my snarl relax into a smile and unclenched my teeth. I stepped back, letting her off the wall. "Your pardon, my lady," I said, and sketched her a shallow bow. She was tall, nearly my height, and surely not many years my senior. She gave me a fierce grin and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. It came away bloody, from a bitten tongue. Gods, but she was good to look at. She had a strong face, sharp in the nose and cheekbones, but rich in the lips, all framed by the darkest red hair.
"Lord, how you stink, boy," she said.
She stepped around me, as if she was checking a horse at market.
You're lucky Sir Galen isn't with me, or a skivvy would be picking your head off the ground about now.
Sir Galen? I asked. I'll be sure to watch out for him. She had diamonds around her neck on a complex web of gold. Spannard work. None on the horse coast could make a thing like that. It wouldn't do for the king's guests to go about killing one another. I took her for the daughter of a merchant, come a-toadying to the king. A very rich merchant. Or maybe the daughter of some count or earl from the east. There was an eastern burr to her voice.
You're a guest?
She raised a brow at that, and very pretty it looked too.
I think not. You look to have stolen in. By the privy shoot, to judge by the smell. I don't think you could have climbed the walls, not in that clunky old armour.
I clicked my heels together, like the table knights, and offered her an arm. I was on my way to break fast in the kitchens. They know me there. Perhaps you'd like to accompany me and check my credentials, lady. She nodded, ignoring my arm.
I can send a kitchen boy for the guards and have you arrested, if we don't meet any on the way.
So we walked side by side, through the corridors, and down one flight of stairs after another. My brothers call me Jorg, I said. How are you called, lady? I found the court speak awkward on the tongue, especially with my mouth so unaccountably dry. She smelled like flowers.
You can call me my lady,
she said, and wrinkled her nose again. We passed two of the house guards in their fire-bronze plate and plumes. Both of them studied me as if I was a turd escaped from the privy. But she said nothing, and they let us pass. We passed the storerooms where the salt beef and pickled pork lay in barrels, stacked to the ceiling. My lady seemed to know the way. She shot me a glance with those emerald eyes of hers.
So, did you come here to steal, or for murder with that dagger of yours?
She asked. Perhaps a bit of both, I smiled. A good question, though. I couldn't say why I'd come, other than I felt somebody didn't want me to. Ever since that moment when I found Father Gompst in his cage, ever since that ghost ran its course through me, and my thoughts turned to the tall castle, it felt as though someone was steering me away. And I don't take direction. We passed Short Bridge. Little more than three mahogany planks over the great iron valves that could seal the lower levels from the castle main. The doors, steel and 3 feet thick, would slide up from the gaping slot in the corridor floor. So Tutor Lundis told me. Lifted on old magic. I'd never seen them close. Torches burned here. No silver lamps for the servant levels. The stink of tar smoke made me more at home than anything yet. Perhaps I'll stay, I said. The kitchen arch lay just ahead of us. I could see Drain, the assistant cook, wrestling half a hog through the doors.
Wouldn't your brothers miss you?
She asked, playful now. She touched her fingers to the corner of her mouth, where the red pattern of my fingers had started to rise. Something in her gesture made me rise too. I shrugged, then paused as I worked the straps of the vambrace over my left forearm. There are plenty of brothers on the road, I said. Let me show you the kind of brothers I meant.
Here,
she said, impatient. The torchlight burned in the red of her hair. She undid the clasps with deft fingers. The girl knew armor. Perhaps Sir Galen was for more than just beheading ill-mannered louts.
What then?
She asked.
I've seen arms before. Though maybe not one so dirty.
I grinned at that and turned my arm over so she could see the Brotherhood brand across my wrist. 3 ugly bands of burn scar. A look of distaste furrowed her brow.
You're a sellsword! You take your pride in that?
More pride in that than in what true family I have left. I felt a bite of anger. I felt like sending this distracting merchant's daughter on her way, making her run.
What are these?
She reached out to run her fingers from the brand up to the small of my elbow, where the armor stopped her.
Jeez, you! There's more scar than boy under this dirt!
At her touch, a thrill ran through me, and I pulled away. I fell in a thorn bush when I was a child, I said, my voice too sharp.
Some thorn bush, she said.
I shrugged. A hook briar. She twisted her mouth into an ouch.
You've got to lie still in one of those,
she said, her eyes still on my arm.
Everyone knows that. Looks as if it tore you to the bone.
I know that. Now. I set off for the kitchen doors, walking fast. She ran to catch me, silk swirling.
Why did you struggle? Why didn't you stop?
I was stupid, I said. I wouldn't struggle now. I wanted the silly bitch to leave. I didn't even feel hungry anymore. My arm burned with the memory of her fingers. She was right. The thorns had cut me deep. Every few weeks for more than a year, the poison would flare in the wounds and run through my blood. When the poison ran in me, I'd done things that scared even the brothers. Drain lumbered out through the doors just as I reached them. He pulled up short and wiped his hands on the soiled, white apron stretched over his belly.
What?
He looked past me, and his eyes widened.
Princess!
He seemed suddenly terrified, quivering like a blob of jelly.
Princess! What are you doing in the kitchens? It's no place for a lady in silks and all.
Princess? I turned to stare at her. I'd left my mouth open, so I closed it. She gave me a smile that left me wondering if I wanted to slap it off her or kiss it. Before I could decide, a heavy hand landed on my shoulder and Drain turned me round.
And what's a ruffian like you doing leading Her Highness astray?
The question died in his throat. His fat face crinkled up, and he tried to speak again, but the words wouldn't come. He let me go and found his voice.
Jorg? Little Jorg?
Tears streamed down his cheeks. Will and I had watched the man throttle a few chickens and bake a few pies. There was no call for him to start blubbing over me. I let him off the embarrassment, though. He'd given me the chance to see Her Royal Highness look surprised. I grinned at her and gave a court bow.
Princess, eh? So I guess that means the road trash you wanted to have the palace guards arrest is, in fact, your stepbrother.
She recovered her composure quickly. I'll give her that.
Actually, that would make you my nephew, she said. Your father married my older sister 2 months ago. I'm your Aunt Catherine.
Chapter 20. We sat at the long trestle where the kitchen skivvies ate their meals, Aunt Catherine and I. The servants cleared the low vault and brought in more light, candles of every length and girth in clay holders. They watched from the doorways at either end, a shabby crowd, grinning and bobbing, as though it was a holy day or a high day, and we were the mummers to entertain them. Drain hove into view, and crested through the skivvies like a barge through water. He brought fresh bread, honey in a bowl, golden butter, and silver knives. This is the place to eat, I said. I kept my eyes on Catherine. She didn't seem to mind. Bread hot from the oven. It steamed when I tore it open. Heaven must smell like fresh bread.
I knew I missed you for a reason, Drain.
I called the words over my shoulder. I knew the fat cook would bask in that for a year. I hadn't missed him. I hadn't spared him but one thought for every 100 times I dreamed of his pies. In fact, I'd struggled to remember his name when I saw him in the doorway. But something about the girl made me want to be the kind of man who would remember.
The first bite woke my hunger, and I tore at the loaf as though it were a haunch of venison, and me huddled on the road with the brothers. Catherine paused to watch, her knife suspended above the honey bowl, her lips twitching with a smile. I chewed and swallowed.
What?
I demanded.
She's probably wondering if you'll go under the table when the bread's gone and wrestle the dogs for bones.
Makin had come up behind me unnoticed.
Damn, but you'd make a good footpad, Sir Makin.
I swung round to find him standing over me, his armour gleaming. A man in plate mail should have the decency to clank.
I clank plenty, Prince, he said.
He showed me an annoying smile.
You had your mind on more pressing matters, maybe?
He bowed toward Catherine. My lady, I haven't had the honour. She extended a hand to him.
Princess Catherine ap Scorin.
Makin raised a brow at that. He took her hand and bowed again, much more deeply, lifting her fingers to his lips. He had thick lips, sensuous. He'd washed his face and his hair gleamed as much as his armour, coal black and curled. He cleaned up well, and for the smallest moment, I hated him without reservation.
Take a seat, I said. I'm sure the excellent drain can find more bread.
He let go of her hand, too slowly for my liking.
Sadly, my prince, duty rather than hunger brings me to the kitchens. I thought I might find you here. You're summoned to the throne room. There must be 100 squires hunting the halls for you.
You also, princess. He favoured her with an appreciative stare.
I met a fellow named Galen searching for you.
Something tight laced those last words. Makin didn't like Sir Galen any more than I did. And he'd met the man. I took the bread with me. It was too good to leave. We found our way back above ground. The tall castle appeared to have woken up during my trip to the kitchens. Squires and maids ran this way and that. Guards passed by in twos and fives, bound for their duties. We skirted a lord in his furs and gold chain, girded by flunkies, leaving him with his astonishment, his bowing, and his "Good morning, princess." By corridor and hall, we reached Torrent Vault, the antechamber before the throne room, where the tawny armour of past kings lined the walls like hollow knights standing silent vigil.
Prince Honorus Jorg Ancrath and the Princess Catherine.
Makin announced us to the guards before the doors. He placed me before the princess. A small matter on the road, but a touch that spoke volumes in the Torrent Vault. Here is the heir to the throne. Let him in. The crested guardsmen, flanking the hallway, stood as still as the armour on the stands behind them. They followed us only with their eyes. Gauntleted hands kept folded on the pommels of their great swords, set point to floor. The two table knights at the throne room doors exchanged a glance. They paused for a moment to bow to Catherine, then set to work drawing the great doors open wide enough to admit us. I recognised one of them by the coat of arms on his breastplate, horns above an elm. Sir Riley. He'd turned grey in the years I'd been gone. He struggled with his door, straining to move the oak in its bronze cladding. The doors parted. Our narrow view grew from a sliver of warm light to a window on a world I once knew. The court of the Ancrath kings.
Princess.
I took her hand, holding it high, and we walked through. The men that built the tall castle lacked nothing in skill and everything in imagination. Their walls might remain for 10,000 years, but they would hold no artistry. The throne room was a windowless box. A box 100 feet on every side, maybe, and with a 20-foot ceiling to dwarf the courtiers, but a box nonetheless. Elaborate wooden galleries for the musicians muted the harsh corners, and the king's dais added a certain splendour. I kept my eyes from the throne.
The Princess Catherine ap Scorin,
the herald called.
No mention of poor Georgie. No herald would dare such a slight without instruction. We crossed the wide floor, our pace measured, watched by the guardsmen at the walls. Men with crossbows by the walls to left and right, swordsmen at the plinth and by the door. I might have been nameless, but my arrival had certainly roused some interest. In addition to the guardsmen, and despite the early hour, at least 100 courtiers formed our audience. They waited attendance on the throne, milling around the lower steps in their velvets. I let my eyes stray across the glittering crowd, pausing to linger on the finest jewels. I still had my road habits, and made mental tally of their worth. A new charger on that countess's fat bosom alone. That lord's chain of office could buy 10 suits of scale armour. There was surely a fine longbow and a pony in each of his rings. I had to remind myself I played for new stakes now. Same old game, new stakes. Not higher, but different. The gentle chatter of the court rose and fell as we approached. The soft hubbub of knife-edged comments, damaging sarcasm, honeyed insults. Here the sharp intake of breath at the prince coming to court, still wearing the robe. There the mocking laughter, half hidden behind a silk handkerchief. I let myself look at him then. 4 years had wrought no change in my father. He sat on the high-backed throne, hunched in a wolf-skin robe, edged with silver. He'd worn the same robe on the day I left. The Ancrath crown rested on his brow. A warrior crown, an iron band set with rubies, confining black hair streaked with the same grey as the iron. To his left in the consort chair, the new queen sat. She had Catherine's looks, though softer, with a web of silver and moonstones to tame her hair. Any sign of her pregnancy lay hid beneath the ivory froth of her gown. Between the thrones grew a magnificent tree, wrought all of glass. Its leaves the emerald of Catherine's eyes, wide and thin and many. It reached a slender 9 feet in height, its twigs and branches gnarled and vitreous, brown as caramel. I'd never seen the like before. I wondered if it might be the queen's dowry. Surely it had the worth. Sages stood beside the glass tree, in the dappled green light beneath its leaves. He'd abandoned the simple white he'd worn when first we met, in favour of black robes, high in the collar, with a rope of obsidian plates about his neck. I met his eyes as we approached, and manufactured a smile for him. The courtiers drew back before us, making to the fore, Catherine and me hand in hand. The perfumes of lords and ladies tickled at my nose, lavender and orange oil. On the road, shit has the decency to stink. Only 2 steps down from the throne, a tall knight stood in magnificent plate. The iron worked over with fire bronze, twin dragons coiling on his breastplate in a crimson inferno. Sir Galen, Makin hissed the words back at me. I glanced at Catherine and found her smile unreadable. Galen watched us with hot blue eyes. I liked him a little better for wearing his hostility so plainly. He had the blonde hair of a Teuton, his features square and handsome. He was old, though, as old as Makin, 30 summers at the least. Sir Galen made no move to let Makin past. We stopped 5 steps down. Father, I said. In my head, I'd made my speech 100 times, but somehow the old bastard managed to steal the words from my tongue. The silence stretched between us. I hope, I started again, but he cut over me.
Sir Makin,
Father said, not even looking at me.
When I send the captain of the palace guard out to retrieve a 10-year-old child, I expect him to return by nightfall. Perhaps a day or 3 might suffice if the child proved particularly elusive.
Father raised his left hand from the arm of the throne, just by an inch or two, but enough to cue his audience. A scattered tittering sounded among the ladies, cut off when his fingers returned to the iron wood of the chair. Makin bowed his head and said nothing.
A week or two on such a task would signify incompetence. More than 3 years speaks of treason.
Makin looked up at that. Never, my king. Never treason.
We once had reason to consider you fit for high office, Sir Makin,
Father said, his voice as cold as his eyes.
So you may explain yourself.
The sweat gleamed on Makin's brow. He'd have gone through this speech as many times as I had mine. He'd probably lost it just as profoundly.
The prince has all the resourcefulness one might hope for in the heir to the throne,
Makin began. I saw the queen frown at his turn of phrase. Even Father's mouth tightened, and he glanced at me, fleeting and unreadable.
When at last I found him, we were in hostile lands, Jaceth, more than 300 miles to the south.
I know where Jaceth is, Sir Makin, Father said. Do not presume to lecture me on geography.
Makin inclined his head.
Your Majesty has many enemies, as do all great men in these times of trouble. No single blade, even one as loyal as my own, could protect your heir in such lands as Jaceth. Prince Jorg's best defence lay in anonymity.
I glanced over the court. It seemed that Makin's speech had not deserted him after all. His words had an impact. Father ran a hand over his beard.
Then you should have ridden back to the castle with a nameless charge, Sir Makin. I wonder that this journey took 4 years.
The prince had taken up with a band of mercenaries, Your Majesty. By his own skill, he won their allegiance. He told me plain that if I moved to take him, they would kill me, and that if I stole him away, he would announce himself to every passerby. And I believed him, for he has the will of an Ankrath.
Time to be heard, I thought.
4 years on the road have given you a better captain, I said. There's more to learn about making war than can be discovered in this castle.
You lack enterprise, Sir Makin,
Father said. His eyes never flickered from Makin. I wondered if I'd spoken at all. Anger tinged his voice now.
Had I ridden after the boy, I would have found a way to return him from Jaceth within a month.
Sir Makin bowed deeply.
That is why you deserve your throne, Majesty, whilst I am merely captain of your palace guard.
You are the captain of my guard no longer,
Father said.
Sir Galen serves in that capacity now, as he served the House of Scorn.
Galen offered Makin the slightest of bows, a mocking smile on his lips.
Perhaps you would like to challenge Sir Galen for your old office?
Father asked. Again he fingered his salt and pepper beard. I sensed the trap here. Father didn't want Makin back.
Your Majesty has chosen his captain, Makin said. I would not presume to overwrite that decision with my sword.
He sensed the trap too.
Indulge me.
Father smiled then, for the first time since our entrance, and it was a cold thing.
The court has been quiet in your absence. You owe us some entertainment. Let us have a show.
He paused.
Let us see what you have learned on the road.
So he did hear me.
Father,
I started, and again he cut me off. I couldn't seem to rise above him.
Sages, take the boy,
he said. And that was that. The heathen had his eyes on me, and led me mild as a sheep to stand with him between the thrones. Catherine shot me a pale glance, and hastened to her sister's side.
Makin and Galen bowed to the king.